It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus. Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving at your desk, maybe at the gym, but you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach and see a rocket launch or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Well, hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Cricket Unfiltered podcast. I'm your co-host, Menas. Joining me is Paul, the Summer Game Dennett. Paul, how are you today?
I'm good, Menas. I've discovered on the BBC Test Match podcast that they've got lots of old interviews that they've done with celebrities at the cricket, and I've been listening to one, Jonathan Agnew, interviewing pop star Lily Allen a decade ago, and she said that the Ashes should be the best of 9 test matches. And having listened to that and watched his last episode of the test, which was fantastic, I completely agree with her that we need more Ashes cricket. It's the best. Maybe we need it 52 weeks in a year.
Yeah, what about bringing another country into the mix, like letting India, say, compete for the Ashes, Paul? How would that go with you?
Well, my good friend and our good friend Patrick Avenell has always said that the Ashes will eventually become a 3-match T20 series between Mumbai Indians and Chennai Super Kings. So I'm sure it's only a matter of time.
Well, listeners, on that positive note, we're going to kick things off. A lot to come in this podcast. We're going to review the final episode of Amazon's The Test. That's right, episode 8. But before we get into that, Paul, I guess quite a momentous thing has happened in Australia. As you know, I'm a big fan of the NRL or rugby league, if you're, you know, from other parts of the world. And, you know, it's not the first sport in the world to kick off, but it's in the, you know, the first few sports to actually get back going after the lockdown. And there will be a few lessons that the cricket administrators can learn from what rugby league's doing right now.
Yeah, a special shout out to Australian horse racing, which, true to its roots, has barely noticed that it's just continued through the entire situation, which is typical of horse racing. But yeah, the NRL is back, and it's interesting. There's talk of whether that when Australia and New Zealand start to have transfers between the two countries again, whether we should get some sort of Trans-Tasman series underway. I suppose one of the big advantages of cricket right now, if they could get some form of cricket on the box, is the lack of competition in the rest of the world. And I'm not suddenly saying that there'll be live screens in in South America where people will be watching it, but it's a chance to grow the game. And maybe they should have a New South Wales versus rest of Australia T20 series at Darwin and make it free to anywhere in the world and make it a nice, fast, bouncy pitch and try to promote the game when there's this chance.
I think it's a big opportunity. And we saw with the NRL, they got monster ratings the first weekend back. You know, a lot of publicity, by people that aren't normally fans of the game have said they're, you know, watching it because they want to see some live action, some live sport. So, you know, there's a real opportunity for cricket to maybe, you know, get some monster TV numbers if they could get a series going, and you might attract a few people that hadn't watched the game much before. I mean, Paul, jokes aside, you know, I'm not a huge fan of rugby league, but I actually, a couple of times on the weekend, turned it on to watch a bit of live sport. Imagine you could get that buzz into cricket, a T20 series, Australia v New Zealand, men and women, sort of back to back. I just think you could, it'd be silly to waste this opportunity when, you know, they're panicking at Jolimont sacking people all around the country. Why not use this opportunity and try and make an event that, wasn't there before?
Absolutely. And I can understand if you were in charge of Cricket Australia, you're kind of looking out for your own short-term finances, which is understandable. But if there was, if the International Cricket Council really was the body it should be, they'd be able to say to Cricket Australia, listen, just get something up. We'll fund it. We'll sell it wherever we can. Make sure it's a good pitch. Make sure the players are told to hit lots of sixes. And let's see if we can make a bit of a splash on the world. And it will ultimately be only to the benefit of everyone.
I mean, I sort of look at the ratings that the Big Bash was doing, you know, a couple of years ago before they went to from free-to-air to cable TV. And they were getting, for Big Bash games, you know, well over a million viewers. And that was with other sport going on, et cetera. Imagine you could get, you know, Australia taking on the Kiwis, you know, on a Friday night, say 2 weeks from this Friday, I reckon you'd get well over a million Aussies tuning in for that. And it would be great for the game.
Yeah, but for me, it would be the international audience that I've heard, for example, a rugby union fan in England posted he's never watched the NRL before and was pleasantly surprised at what an attractive product it was. I would like to imagine that there could be your equivalent somewhere in America who's never seen a game of cricket before and watches it and says, oh, I'm a big baseball fan. I can see what this cricket thing's all about now.
Yeah. And there's a few other things about the practicalities of broadcasting sport in the current environment. So I saw that Fox Sports are using the crowd noise, the fake crowd noise, in a very interesting way. And I've heard them say that they're trying to, you know, think of the artificial crowd noise as like a musical instrument. You know, they're trying to match the noise to the action. And, you know, in rugby league, as they move down the field towards the try line, the crowd gets louder and louder. So I think, you know, when it comes to televising cricket, they'll need to look at ways like that, which are going to be more challenging for cricket because it's sort of taken from a wider shot. But I think there are lessons to be learned.
It's quite extraordinary that the technology that was pioneered in the 1930s by Australian radio stations, where they actually had a record player of crowd noise when they're doing the synthetic broadcasts from England. Who would have thought, with all our technology 9 decades later, that we're kind of reduced to being back at the same point? I haven't actually had a chance to watch any rugby league. What did you think of the crowd noise being piped in? Did you like it?
Yeah, I did like it, and I think it was well thought out. It wasn't just let's just play some background noise. They've got some people who've put some real thought into this, and you know, really score it and make it a proper effort at it. And I think, you know, rugby league's easier because, you know, the shots can be quite in tight, the camera shots. And, you know, in a lot of rugby league games, you don't get a crowd anyway, so it's no big difference. But, yeah, I think there's something to be learned there, that when cricket does go back on air, they need to be smart the way they do it.
As long as it's not faking. I mean, everyone watching knows the crowd noise is not real, or would some people think it is real?
It's just atmospheric. I mean, you know, you watch the sort of the cricket, say, from the SCG when Australia hosted New Zealand and it sounded very hollow. I think when you add the sort of underlying track of an artificial crowd, you do take that hollowness out of the coverage.
Mm. I am so, I suppose, stupid that I don't like comedy shows where they don't have a laugh track. I like the canned laughter to tell me when to laugh. So maybe it would be right up my alley.
And then the other thing is that they're having to commentate the games off TV. And this is something that actually I think happens in sport more than viewers might be aware. I know a lot of the football codes in Australia that some of the games are often done off TV just to save costs. But when you look at cricket, I know Talk Sport in England, they cover the IPL off the television. So they bring their commentators in and they commentate off the TV coverage. I don't mind it. I mean, it's different because, you know, the commentator doesn't see the whole field. But I think you could, you and I, for example, Paul, could do a pretty good job commentating, say, the Sheffield Shield off TV if we had to.
Yeah, or the World Cup final, if anyone's interested. But I think that in this situation, there's no choice. Absolutely do it. But in the normal course of events, I absolutely hate it. I really get angry when they do it because I can tell that they're not there. The sound mix sounds wrong. It's insulting to the viewers. And even when they have a studio commentator and they have a couple of balls before they throw back to the live commentary team, the sound mix is all really bad and I can't stand it. But at the moment, I'm happy for it to go past. Let it go by, but I don't want it to become something that's regular. And I would never watch coverage where they did it for any length of time, or I'd mute it anyway.
Yeah, I prefer the commentators being at the ground, and I think you get a better product when the commentators can see, you know, the whole picture and not just what the TV's showing them. And then last thing was, and this is a little bit dodgy, Paul, you might have some thoughts about this. They offered people the chance to, you know, pay to have a cardboard cutout of themselves placed in the crowd. But for every however many normal people there are, there's always a few people that see this as an opportunity to make some pretty poor tasting jokes. And some of those cardboard cutouts have been serial killers and dictators and, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I would have preferred if they just put someone obscure there, like David Letterman or someone, just someone not so offensive. Although the one I did find funny was that they put Dominic Cummings, who's in trouble in England, the advisor to Boris Johnson for having travelled to Durham in violation of the lockdown over there. So it's kind of like he's also popped in to attend an NRL game. I couldn't help but chuckle at that one.
Yeah. I mean, there were some amusing ones, but so that's something if cricket wants to do that, they'll have to have someone checking the photos. Now, the other news is the cricket schedule for next summer has been announced. And listeners to the show will know Paul and I are debuting our live YouTube show this Thursday at 5:30 p.m. Now, we're going to stream that across all our socials, so it will be streaming it to our Twitter, to our Facebook, and it'll be on YouTube. So we're going to go in depth, I think, in all the cricket news and a bit of this schedule. And I guess overall, I feel a bit hollow about the schedule announcement, Paul, because there's so much uncertainty about the future. So it's hard to get too invested. But the main point is that Perth have missed out on hosting India this time. And this is not great for the Perth. And they built that great new stadium. They won't have India.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that Perth has almost painted themselves into a corner because the WACA is going to be what's used for the Afghanistan game, which is fair enough, but the WACA is going to be reduced in size. So the WACA could never host a test match against a major country like India or England because the crowd wouldn't be able to fit in. Yet, even though they actually got good crowds for the game against New Zealand last summer, sort of record-breaking crowds, you know, 20,000 in that 60,000-seat stadium, it just looks terrible and soulless. And that's going to be a problem for Perth. I mean, they've only got 2 million people. There's no one from anywhere else that can casually drive by because it's so isolated. 20,000 in a city of 2 million isn't that bad. But what's going to happen in the future? Are we sort of destined forever to have half-empty crowds whenever a big team plays in Perth? It's a bit of a pity.
Yeah, I don't see that as being a major issue myself. I think that, especially if they were to get a big team like India and play, say, a day-night test there, they could probably get pretty good crowds. But I think it's more an issue that we really should try and somehow get India to play 5 tests when they come here. There's no doubt that if England can come and play 5 tests, that India shouldn't do the same. Then all our major test venues get a game, and I think you have a brilliant 5-test battle.
Absolutely. And I don't know why that they're not. I mean, is it because Cricket Australia feel that they've got to squeeze in Afghanistan somehow, or is it that India don't want to do it? But we always hear them going on about the primacy of Test cricket. Well, if we're only having 5 Test series against England and really only 4 Test series against India and everyone else is 3 Tests or fewer, then that doesn't really cut it. And I think that Australia-India deserves 5 Test matches. It deserves to dominate the summer. And it's a real pity that they're only going to have four, as they have done in the last few.
Well, I echo those sentiments, Paul. And with that, we will now get into our final review of Amazon's The Test. That's right, episode 8. I like this episode, Paul, because I think cricket really took the center stage. And, the cricket was so breathtaking that was covered in this episode that I thought it was a good show.
I thought it was the best, and I agree. It was the best because the cricket was so good. And as painful as the Headingley result was for Australian fans, it's undeniable that the drama was just something else. And so the only sad point was right at the end when they had to deal with the Oval Test match. It's a pity that the Oval and Old Trafford results hadn't been reversed. If Australia could have retained the Ashes at the Oval, that would have been a fitting climax to a wonderful series. But yeah, on the whole, I think I'd rate this the number one episode.
I mean, the director could have done something about this, Paul. They could have cut it together so it made it seem like we won the last test somehow. Could they have, switched the order of the way they showed it and, showed the Oval, then Australia comes back at Old Trafford to win the Ashes? Paul's not biting. All right, so
I would have preferred that they did what they did in the Steve Waugh Perfect Day documentary, that they concluded it with him getting his 100 and they didn't show that he got out first over next day and that Australia lost the test match. But they could have just concluded the documentary after Old Trafford and put a tiny little note. The fifth test match was actually won by England to draw the series, and that's it.
They should have done that, actually. Absolutely. And said it as quick as you said it. And now, this one picks up after the Lord's test. So we've seen Smith be replaced. They're on the way to Leeds for the third test. And straight off the bat, the doctor says in a team meeting, Steve Smith shouldn't play the next test. And Justin Langer says that, well, if Steve Smith's saying he's not 100%, the guy loves batting, there must be something wrong. So we can't, try and push him into playing. Obviously, it starts off with that being a huge loss for the team.
Yes. And it's to the credit of everyone involved. The temptation to try to convince him to play must have been strong. And as I said last episode, congratulations to the Australian medical staff and to Justin Langer for putting the players' long-term health ahead of any short-term gains. I wonder whether every other nation would have done that. Well done, Cricket Australia.
All right, so we're at Leeds, Headingley. Australia is sent into bat by Joe Root on a green top and a rock and roll for 179, Australia all out at the end of day one. And then day two starts and the sun is out. And I've got to admit, I remember sitting at home on my couch thinking, this is not good. We've batted in the worst conditions. Now the sun's out. This is tailor-made for England to get a huge lead over Australia. And Payne says basically the same thing. He saw the sun out and thought, all right, here we go. This is great. But then, they build up the fact that this is the first time ever Cummins, Pattinson and Hazelwood have bowled together in the same Australian team. Well, Paul, I mean, this is just one of the, I love this whole night. I mean, this is one of the best nights I can remember in a long time. England rock and rolled for 67. David Warner took some great catches. We have Justin Langer sort of saying, oh, how good would it be on it to be home in Australia tonight at the pub watching England get rock and roll for 60-odd. Pat Cummins said it was, the best couple of hours he's seen the team bowl. And Agnew at lunch said he had a very serious conversation on the BBC that they have just witnessed possibly the end of Test cricket in England. So, I mean, obviously, can we just stop the Test analysis at this bit and move on to Old Trafford? But great stuff.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And I felt exactly the same as you. That why is the world against us? Why do we have to bowl in the sun? To bowl them out for 67, great credit to all the bowlers and to the bowling coach. Well done. I was in the pub, Justin Langer saying how good it would have been. I hate to disappoint him, but everyone in the pub except me was watching the rugby league. They were flicking across with their eyes each time Australia got a wicket and cheering, but not quite as romantic a notion as JL was.
You need to find new pubs to go to, I'm afraid, mate.
Yeah, well, if the cricket's on Gem, most pubs aren't even showing it because they don't know where Gem is. Find me a pub on a Friday night in Australia. Even during the Ashes when everyone's watching that rather than the rugby league or the Australian rules football, and I'll go there every single time. Please urgently tell me where that pub is because I don't know if it exists. Jonathan Agnew, what was he on about? The whole notion of would this be the end of Test cricket in England? It was bad, but it wasn't that bad. I found that a little bit strange.
Yeah, I think it must have been talking about the context of coming out of the 50-over World Cup and now they're seeing England get humiliated David Warner's catches were unforgettable. I'd forgotten how good those catches were at first slip. I mean, on another day, they would have gone through. You know, they were just flying.
Yeah, and they don't get the recognition they deserve. Everyone says what a horrible series he had, and he did, but that was almost match-winning. If Australia had gone on to win that match, those catches would have been crucial. His likely replacement, whoever that might have been, probably wouldn't have caught all of them. So, yeah, fantastic catching from Warner.
So Australia get a big lead, 112 on the first innings, and then Australia are all out for 246 in their second innings, setting England 369 to win, which would be their biggest ever chase in their history of Test cricket. You know, Australia did mess up a little bit here, Paul, because just sort of aside from the documentary, we really should have batted them out of the game at that point and made the target well over 400, considering it was so early on in the game. Australia probably missed the chance to really put the game out of reach, but then England are 3 for 141, enter Ben Stokes. You know, Langer at one point says, we've got to get Stokes out, and he was 100% right.
Yeah, you've written in the notes here that we should skip past this bit. I think we're obliged to, we have to acknowledge that this day did occur. As painful
have
as
you
it
noticed
was.
The details have diminished in this section? All of a sudden, yeah. I've gone from micro-analysis to, oh, yeah, this happened, and the next game.
Yes, and as painful as it was captivating. And, you know, as a, I can objectively look at it and say, as a cricket fan,
same.
I am pleased that it gave the Ashes that huge kick along, and it was just wonderful seeing the crowd loving it so much, even though.
But
was,
see,
was...
my thing is, we could have got all that if Lyon had affected that run out. We could have had this amazing finish and Australia win by one run. That would have been ideal.
Yeah, that would have been. And
you know, rewatching that, I'd forgotten like how phenomenal that day of cricket was. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it was just breathtaking. Travis Head's run out of Butler. And then Travis Head takes an amazing catch on the boundary where, and any other day, that's a classic. You know, the game on the line, he throws it back in. We had all that.
The thing is that this was better than the World Cup final. The World Cup final was fantastic in its last little bit because it was so close. But one day cricket, when they're just milking the singles, even when there's high tension, can't match the drama of Test cricket where every run you score, you're still earning it and that the contest is still there. I would defy anyone who likes sport who's never seen cricket before, if they watched that day at Headingley, they would come away saying that was as good as sport can get.
Yeah, hard to argue. So, yeah, if you have missed it, England were 9 for 286. And this point, Mitch Marsh is saying, we're home here in the dressing room, we're home. We're going to go 2-0 up in the Ashes. And I actually think that had Australia gone on and won that game then, Australia might have gone on and just won the series 4-0 because, you know, that really was such a pivotal moment that Australia could have ran away with this series. But then the Australian dressing room, you can see, starts to get nervous really quickly when Stokes open up. And Justin Langer says at one point to the camera, the biggest man on the ground is pressure. And you have to say, even watching back, Australia didn't handle that pressure very well.
Yeah, I mean, Stokes' innings was sublime, but I found a very interesting point, the fact that Langer was so obviously angry that Payne wasn't bringing the field up at the end of each over. Now, I completely agree that that's what Payne should have been doing, but what I don't understand is why wasn't Langer sending a message out to that effect? I think it's strange that he's making that point, but they're not doing anything about it.
Yeah, I wonder why he didn't send a runner out. Maybe there is still that sort of old notion that once the captain's out there, it's his, you know, he's in charge and there's some kind of sanctity around that.
Yeah, but later on when they have the debrief and watch that part of it in the team meeting, Payne says something that took words to the effect of people were coming on and telling us to bowl slower balls and other things. He didn't say it directly, but the implication was that these were people coming on from off the field to tell him. So I think that maybe there were runners coming out saying things, so I don't know why they wouldn't have been saying you've got to keep the field up to Stokes to keep him away from the strike next over.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we get to the closing stages of this game and Marcus Harris drops Ben Stokes and he says that's the worst feeling he's ever had in cricket, and I can imagine that would be a very hollow feeling. And then we, you know, the Cummins review and the Nathan Lyon run out miss. But what I enjoyed the inside of was the reaction in the dressing room when Lyon missed that run out. You know, they had the shot in there. You could tell the tension in the dressing room was incredible.
Yeah, the drama was immense. Was that when Langer kicked over the bin?
Yeah.
And then put the contents of the rubbish back in? I wonder if that was him being aware of the cameras being on, because I can empathise with kicking over the bin. But if I'd been in that situation and there'd been no cameras on me, I wouldn't have picked the rubbish up. I might have picked it up half an hour later, but at the time, I wouldn't have wanted to miss the next ball.
Yeah. Smith was distraught. Apparently Langer actually asked for that bit to be taken out when he kicked the bin originally. But, yeah, Smith was distraught at the missed run out. And then I can't even go through it again, but then, the appeal against Stokes that was given not out.
We have to go through it briefly.
Well, what do you want to say? I mean,
a couple of things. One, Stokes was plum, and it's unfair that the umpire was in that situation where he makes an incorrect decision and 5 seconds later the whole world knows that it was out. Stokes said it was missing, and other people said that it was missing. They're wrong. They don't understand Hawkeye. It was plum. Cricket needs to ensure that this stops happening. We've got the technology. We need to have a system in place that a major moment like this is not decided by an umpiring error. Taking nothing away from England's win, Australia stuffed it up. But I think, as a sort of a cricket fan, I don't want this to happen. And the whole, why did they take the review? Now, I understand that.
So this is the Cummins review?
Yeah. I mean, you've got the feeling of we might as well. But Cummins later on said that it definitely pitched outside leg. Had they planned enough for that? We didn't see any planning meetings for DRS, and obviously we didn't see a lot of things. Maybe they had pragmatic, very documented plans in place, but they always seem to be going on and on about passion and mindset and running through brick walls and doing it for your country and all this. Was there enough cold, hard, pragmatic planning? I'm not sure.
So England win. It's the biggest chase in their history. Series is level one all. I think the most compelling bit of the whole documentary was the 10 minutes that dealt with the fallout from the Headingley loss. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back after the break and talk about that fallout, because it's compelling viewing. Before we go, I just want to remind you, if you've got a moment, please go and rate and review the podcast on any app that you listen to the show on. Jeff Riley left a lovely review about the show on Apple Podcasts last week. So thank you, Jeff. So please, if you've got a moment, go and rate and review the show. And as I said, we'll be live 5:30 this Thursday with our very first Cricket Unfiltered live on YouTube and on all our social media. We're going to take a break. Then we're going to come back and you'll hear Steve Smith being asked about whether he watched the test.
I've watched one episode, the premiere that we went to. I don't really like to watch myself too much, so only hitting boundaries, so there probably wasn't much of that.
That was Steve Smith there, asked by Jaleesa Apps whether he had watched Amazon's The Test, and surprisingly, he hasn't. And I wonder about this, Paul, because pre-South Africa sandpaper, Smith was notably said that he would read and keep an eye on everything written about him. But then I wonder if since what happened in South Africa, he's taken a bit more of the approach where maybe it's not a good idea to read and watch everything.
Potentially, yeah. But you were also surprised that Mitchell Starc has only watched the premiere. I think it just shows partially why you and I are not playing for Australia, that they have different priorities, these athletes. They're not as...
Training, batting and bowling.
Yes, exactly. So...
I'm more surprised about Smith, I will say, because I wouldn't be surprised if Smith is lying. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of these cricketers are saying, look, it's better we just say we haven't watched it, because then we can't get any asked any uncomfortable questions.
Yeah, potentially. Certainly if I was Smith, I'd have watched the bits where I did well. So that's a lot of it. But as I said, that's why we're gibbering away about cricket rather than playing it, I think.
So let's get into the test review again. So they come off the field having lost that game at Headingley, and this is the bit that I found very compelling. You know, the players looked shocked, stunned. Some were crying. I mean, they were completely shattered, and I think Gerard Whateley summed it up when he said, it's as tough a loss as anyone has had to swallow in this generation.
Yes, and the way that Payne then spoke just before he headed off to the media was excellent. and he's very sharp and basically making the point of, obviously, this is terrible. We're going to get over this. And just, I can't do it justice. But if you haven't watched it, watch the test and see this bit. I think that it was a particularly inspiring moment from Payne in what must have been a terrible, terrible time.
JL told a great story that night where he's in his room and he was FaceTiming his wife and she said, "What are you drinking?" And he goes, "I'm drinking scotch." And she's like, "You don't drink scotch." And he's like, JL's like, "I do tonight, baby." He was just, so upset after the loss that he turned to a scotch on the rocks to settle his nerves.
Very, very amusing scene, but also showing a bit of amateurism on JL. What you do is, before you call your wife on FaceTime, you put the scotch in the fridge or you hide it somewhere, and then afterwards you have a bit more.
Or you put it in a mug so it just looks like a cup of tea. Then the next morning, the day after the loss, basically JL gets the whole team in the boardroom at the hotel to watch the replay of the last partnership between Leach and Stokes. And a lot of the players were not thrilled with the idea. Nathan Lyon said he particularly didn't want to relive it. But looking back on it, that was a very smart thing Justin Langer did. I think it was very cathartic for that team to confront that last partnership, to do it straight after. I think it was a great way of just exercising the demons from that loss. And, I look at someone like Pat Cummins. I've never seen him look as shattered as he did in that boardroom. So for me, I think Justin Langer, that's a brilliant move.
Yeah, I think it was a good move. I do feel sorry for Nathan Lyon, though. I mean, if I'm wandering past the TV and they have who's going to be eliminated from a reality TV show that I don't care about, I even find that painful viewing. Imagine watching back that situation, knowing that you're going to drop the ball for the run out. Lyon looked sick, and I think it was the most I felt for anyone in the entire documentary. Even when Sean Marsh and Khawaja were ruled out of the World Cup with injuries, it was horrible. This was terrible. I'm impressed that Lyon didn't vomit or just walk out of the door. I think it was a good thing to do. But geez, I felt sorry for Lyon.
So you thought it was a good thing from Langer? Because I thought you wouldn't be a fan of the idea.
No, I think that at least it gets it out there, and that it means that you don't have all these unsaid questions and unthought things. And it also, now this is probably, we go on about criticising psychobabble, and this probably sounds like psychobabble, but maybe it did allow the team to draw a line under it. Say, we've acknowledged it, it's done, we don't have to talk about it anymore, we can move on to the next thing. That's what I feel like saying. Maybe that's not necessarily true, but that's how it felt like for me. One thing I found especially interesting was the confrontation between Payne and Langer about the bringing the field up or not. And I think that, Langer sort of pressuring Payne into sort of admitting that it was the wrong thing to do. Initially, Payne was saying, well, no, we didn't panic. And he was explaining that the reasons they had the field back were sensible reasons, that, they just kind of, they pulled the wrong lever, but it wasn't through panic. But then eventually Payne admitted that he got it wrong. I think he admitted that he got it wrong to keep the peace. And I think, and I could be reading too much into this, but I think he might have been thinking, well, you were sending messages on. Why didn't you send a message to this effect? Why are you having a go at me now, when effectively you were complicit in the decision by not doing anything against it? So I found that a powerful thing. Afterwards, it was interesting that you heard Langer say that Payne had come up to him to say how he had found that very confronting. Why didn't we actually see that conversation? I mean, the documentary's got massive access. Payne and Langer have obviously either held that conversation away from the cameras or asked for it to not be shown, or they've chosen not to show it. That would have been an interesting conversation, because Langer's take on it was that it kind of ended all fine. I'm not so sure. I'd be interested in hearing what Payne's take on it might have been. And last little point in this little monologue, why did we get to celebrate their use of sports science early on with learning how to bowl the ball and at whatever lengths? Surely the question has to be asked, going into day four, why didn't the data scientists say there's at least a possibility that Ben Stokes will be batting with the tail and having a license to swing? What does the data science show? Can we look back and find out, when he does that, if he faces leg spin, he struggles. Let's give Barnes Labuschagne a bowl. Maybe no insights would have come out of it, in which case they could say we checked and there was nothing. But if you're going to laud all the data science, why not actually use it when it really matters?
One, I think, pretty consistent theme throughout our reviews of Amazon to the test is our skepticism around the data science team that is following the team around. All right, so we go from the loss at Leeds up to Old Trafford for the fourth test. The series is 1-1. We see Steve Waugh and Justin Langer talking before, saying they have to keep an eye on Payne. But Smith is back.
Yeah, and Langer said that the week in Derbyshire before that, that he thinks it was one of the best weeks of his coaching career and getting them up for it. And I agree with that. But I also do think that this Ashes series was very typified by the concept of momentum being vastly overrated. Like, you know, after the first test match, Australia were going to win them easily. After the next test match, no. After the third test match, England's going to win them easily. And then after the fourth test match, Australia will win. It's like sometimes it's a contest between bat and ball, and the psychology behind it is overplayed a lot.
So we see the resumption of the Archer v Smith battle in this test match, and Smith convincingly wins it. He makes a brilliant 200, his third century of the summer. Australia make a mammoth 497 for 8, and they do sort of touch on how crucial Payne's half century was in that innings, not just for the team, but also it was his first 50 and 11 test matches for Australia. And you know, Australia were for 225 for 5 and could have been bowled out for 100, under 300, but made almost 500. You know, the game comes down to England being set 382 to win. And on that fourth afternoon, we see Pat Cummins dismiss Root first ball after having Burns out. So all of a sudden, England are 2 for none at the end of the first over. And it's setting up for Australia to retain the Ashes on day 5 at Old Trafford.
Marvellously done. I mean, it was a highly entertaining game, and the way that the documentary managed to convey the tension was superb. I felt for Nathan Lyon again in the tea break, even though I think an impartial person said Australia were likely to win from there, would have said that Australia were on their way to victory. Lyon still looked sick, and that final session was compelling viewing.
I was so nervous watching that game at home, and you know, we see the gamesmanship with Leach, his glasses fogging up, and eventually it looks like England might actually escape with a draw. The light was going, the lights were coming on in the ground, and then finally Payne has a punt and he brings Marnus Labuschagne on to bowl. And the first few balls are terrible, and Justin Langer blows up in the dressing room and goes, "What is he even thinking here? Bowl into the effing rough." And he didn't say the effing bit. And then we see Marnus land one in the rough. It spits out of the rough and catches Leach on the gloves bat and is caught in close. And then, we get to the final wicket where Josh Hazlewood gets Craig Overton LBW, and the review was coming, and the Aussie team, they all realised what was happening. Like, okay, this is going to be this perfect shot here. So perfect theatre. But I liked how the cameraman from the test took another shot from the boundary. So, yeah, that whole last bit was fantastic.
And I think I said in one of our podcasts at the time that I watched on slow motion the Australian player's reaction. And in my opinion, Steve Smith starts celebrating 4 frames before everyone else. And I put that down to that's why he's the best batsman in the world. He just picks things up that fraction of a second faster.
And then we get the contrast from what happened at Headingley in the dressing room to Old Trafford. They're just buzzing. They're dancing. There's music. And they even do a reenactment of the last wicket where Mitch Marsh has to pretend to be Overton and Hazlewood bowls him out LBW. It's just party time in the dressing room. And, yeah, just a complete contrast to Headingley, obviously. And I remember, you know, the next morning, Australian time, some of those players were on like one of the morning shows here, still at Old Trafford, still boozing up late at the night on the pitch. Australia retains the Ashes.
I would have liked it if they had shown more of the celebrations, because the whole thought of, oh, we're going to lose at the Oval hangs over me as I'm watching that. And I know that they had to move things on. But as I said, I would have preferred extra celebrations and a lot less time covering off what happened in the final test.
Same. So then we get to the fifth test at the Oval. As team selection was conveniently never brought up in this series, and they didn't change that policy for the last test. So Stark was left out, not even mentioned. And then we see the most surprising thing I've seen on a cricket field probably since 2005 when Ricky Ponting sent England into bat. Just remember, Australia hasn't won in England for 18 years at this point. We're 2-1 up in the series at the Oval. Good place to bat. Good conditions. Payne wins the toss. For some reason, decides to bowl. And what I found was most telling was the shock in the dressing room. I mean, this was one of the good – I like this bit of the show where they – like JL is like got no idea why Payne decided to bowl. Now, why did Payne go rogue?
I find it strange, the decision itself. I remember at the time I this is not something we're saying in hindsight. We were texting each other right at the time saying this is the wrong decision. But again, I just find it baffling that Langer didn't have an input in it. Now, I understand, as you mentioned earlier, that there's this whole demarcation between what happens on the field and what happens off the field. But surely we're at the point now where the coach has more and more assumed the position of a manager in football, and that what he says should go. It shouldn't be up to Payne. It should have been up to, at the very least, it should not have been a surprise to Langer. He's walked out there and decided to bowl. I think this was very disappointing, and they shouldn't allow that to happen in future. That they've got to be singing from the same sheet.
Oh, yeah, it's an absolute shocker. So, you know, to give you an idea, Paul, I put a tweet out yesterday saying I still can't believe Payne sent England in, and got a swathe of responses. People still believe what I feel, and also feel that it was a big chance lost to win a series in England. But Adita Agarwal, one of our listeners who tweeted this in to that tweet, maybe Langer could have discussed what to opt for with the team instead of talking non-stop nonsense and BS about elite honesty. So, yeah, that was Adita calling it the way he sees it. So,
to be fair to Payne as well, even though we did at the time say it's the wrong thing, I'm sure that there are other things that we said during the series, predictions that we made that were wrong, and we've forgotten them.
You know, we're not the Australian captain. We don't have to be held accountable.
No,
we can just say whatever we want.
I know, but it is a bit thing. It does happen too often. That look, had Australia bowled England out for 70 and then gone and got a 200, everyone who was saying that was the wrong thing to do, they would be no longer mentioning that. You know,
but we didn't. It was sunny. It was good batting conditions. We lost the Test match. And Payne said at the end of the Test match, we were just slightly off. And I think you could sort of see that the team was tired. Smith was tired. You add to that the fact that they didn't elect to bat first. So England win the Test and level the series 2-2. And I have to say that they sort of display that it's a slightly hollow feeling for the series to finish that way after the high of Old Trafford. And I agree with that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think they should present the Ashes trophy. They should have presented the Ashes to Australia after the fourth test. No one kind of wants to be celebrating when you've lost the match. That would have been better. But yeah, as Langer sort of said, we would have taken 2-2 coming into the series, and it's still a great triumph.
Well, I want to ask you about this, Paul, because he says, if I'd been asked on the plane, you will make the semis of the World Cup and retain the Ashes, I would have taken that. Would you? Would you think that's right? Would you have taken that?
It's a strange one. I think you could have said that's probably above what we're expected to do, but I still don't want to settle for that. You know, I still want to.
Because I don't think any Australian coach or captain would have taken that.
Yeah, maybe it's. I suppose it's
like English captains would have. Like that's an English mentality right there.
You're a goose.
I might have taken winning the series over the World Cup. If you'd said we can win the Ashes 3-1 but make the semi-finals of the World Cup, I might have taken that, because the facts are, since we last won a series in England, Australia have won 3 50-over World Cups.
I like the Ashes more than I like the World Cup, but the world cares much more about the World Cup. So if it's up to me, I would have been happy for a 5-0 Ashes loss if we'd won the World Cup.
Now, how did you assess the kind of finish to the series, where, you know, Langer says that you can sort of use Smith's story, this tour, as a metaphor for the team, the fact that he started off the World Cup being booed and then by the end he was given a standing ovation. And we see that. Firstly, what did you think of that? Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I think to a degree. I mean, it's a funny one with Smith that they almost cheered him because for once he hadn't damaged them. He got 80 in the first innings and possibly the best innings he played in the whole series, but then out for 23 in the second innings, clipping one off his sort of hip to a wide-ish leg slip. And it was almost like it was easier to clap him then rather than if he'd gone on and scored another 100 and put things past them. So some people would say, well, you don't get redemption by making runs. What they did in South Africa was wrong, and that will always stand. But I think that I've long since forgiven Smith for his oversights back there. And I think it's great that the crowd were finally recognising that he is one of the greatest batsmen of all time. He made a bit of a mistake, but it shouldn't be something that they go on and on about forevermore.
Yeah. And I like the shots at the end of the two teams having a beer together. Justin Langer made the point that although sometimes it's pretty fierce on the field, it's not war. Yeah. We're all cricketers. And good end to the last line, though, was Justin Langer saying something like, we have to start again. I mean, I don't think cricket's like that, is it?
I think it was partially that he was aware of how quickly they'd have to start again, because just after he came back from the Ashes, he was saying that he went to the West Coast Eagles best and fairest presentation for the Aussie rules and was saying to them, you guys have just finished your season. You're all exhausted. Imagine if next week you had to start it all over again. And they were going, yeah. And he said, well, that's what we have to do. We've come back from the Ashes. There's no rest in cricket. I think that's what he was kind of meaning.
Okay. Well, that was our review of the episode 8. And now I thought, Paul, before we move on, I want to give our overall thoughts and our ranking out of 10 for the series. Now, I've actually put this out to Twitter, and I've got a few from the listeners. I'll read them out before we give ours. So Rob Moody, the host of the Rob Belinda YouTube channel that's so well known for all its cricket highlights. I did call him Rob Belinda a couple of weeks ago, and I meant to call him Rob Moody because I was just reading out the YouTube handle. But he's giving the series 10 out of 10 because it's one of a kind and is bloody grateful for it, and he loved the dressing room insights. Mark West gave it 7, boosted because I pretty much watch anything about cricket. Rob Fairhead, who I finally met, one of our loyal listeners, gave it 9 out of 10, but thinks they should have skipped the third test, Ben Stokes at Headingley. Luke Reynolds gives 9.5, and he says the access behind the scenes was outstanding and something we really hadn't seen before. Lazy Fred in 1971. I'll mark it down to a 6 because I think it was a public relations film, or maybe I'm missing the point. Both captains and Khawaja come out well, though. Simon Goldston gave it a solid 7. Sub Steve, gives it 9.5. But said it was quite painful in moments. And finally, one of our friends, Gus Warland, doesn't understand how to rank something out of 10, so just gave it a brilliant.
I think I'd probably give it a 9 out of 10. I think that the production values were excellent. I enjoyed every episode. I think that the drama that they built into it was superb. The access was excellent. I've had non-cricket fans watching it and thoroughly enjoying it. My friend Mikey in Ireland, who loathed cricket, has been watching it and enjoying it. We made a couple of criticisms about a few minor points, so maybe that's what stops it from a 10, but overall I'd give it a 9 and say it was a wonderful program.
Yeah, look, it was a very good show. I'm obviously a bit of a harder marker. I'm going to give it 6 out of 10.
Oh, you're a fool. I can't just give it a... That's ridiculous. You've gone on for...
Well, I can't give it a...
You've gone on all these weeks how much you've loved it, and now you've given it a 6 out of 10. You don't understand numbers.
But I do. I can't just give good marks for access. Firstly, it was a nice show, but, you know, when you compare it to, say, something like The Last Dance that's been on Netflix at the moment, that show about Michael Jordan, I think that this documentary took the easy way out a lot of the time when it comes to the editorial decisions. It took quite a soft view of the thing, so that's why I mark it down. I think some of the stuff that I would have liked to have heard about players being dropped and players being picked was just never touched on. I think the whole show missed kind of a sort of critical director's eye that drove a narrative that was a bit more than just the ups and downs of the team. But good access, good insights, very watchable, 6.5 out of 10.
Fair enough, but what I don't understand is that you haven't been making these points that very strongly during all of these episodes that we've had. You haven't been talking about it as though you've given it a 6 out of 10. You've been talking about it as though it's kind of an 8 out of 10 or a 9 out of 10. So anyway, I think that The Last Dance is different as well because they're looking back on something that happened 20 years ago. I think that makes it easier to probably be more critical and take those harsh viewpoints, whereas here, I empathise with that. They had built up a relationship with the players and they probably couldn't burn that to some degree.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I do think there is some, you're right, some merit to the fact that, you know, if something's a long time after. But and so I just think it needed a bit more meat to it for me. So great show, though. Great effort. But just into your point, you know, now that I've reflected on it as a whole, that's my mark. I mean, you know, as we went through it, I enjoyed it. And 6 out of 10 is a good mark.
No, it's not. I mean, it's 1.1 above a failure.
Well, that's how I'd say it. It's just above a failure. All right. So if you want to send in your mark for the test, send it in. We'll be debating about this for a while. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Aus Cricket Pod. That's AUS Cricket Pod. We're also on TikTok as Cricket Unfiltered. We're on Facebook as the Australian Cricket Podcast. We're on YouTube as Cricket Unfiltered. If you remember any of that, you're doing better than me, but we'll put it all in the show notes so you can find our live show this Thursday at 5:30. Okay, our last break, and then we'll be back with Can't Let It Go. You're listening to the Cricket Unfiltered podcast. I'm Menas. I'm with Paul. And it's the way we like to end all our shows is with Can't Let It Go. So, Paul, what's been happening? What's your Can't Let It Go?
This is something that I think I'm the only one that gets annoyed about this, but it just bothers me that rewatching the Ashes reminded me again of how everyone is so painstakingly insistent on saying Australia retained the Ashes rather than Australia won the Ashes. And it's like, come on, let's just make it easier for ourselves. And I'd say this if it was England as well. Australia won the Ashes. We have them in our possession. We don't. They're in the Museum of Lords. Figuratively, we have them in our possession. We drew the series and thus we won the Ashes. And if England do that in the future, I'll be saying the same thing. I'm sick of people saying Australia won the Ashes for someone to say, no, you didn't. You retained the Ashes. It's not like Mars is watching and checking our nomenclature. It's fine to say Australia won the Ashes. Let's make it so much easier on ourselves rather than having to sort of tiptoe around things and say it that way. I don't know why it annoys me so much. It just does.
Well, it should annoy you because Australia did win the Ashes. We won the Ashes more so than England won the World Cup. Now, my Can't Let It Go is quite simply, I just so happy that Australia is the number one test nation. I think that obviously there was bigger fish to fry at the time and there was the COVID crisis when it was announced. So, you know, it didn't quite give it the attention it deserves, but I am effing cock-a-hoop that Australia is ranked the best test side in the world, best T20 side in the world, effectively the best cricket nation going around.
Yes, and I think that's, as I said before, I think that Australia do deserve to be the best test side in the world. Indian fans would be aggrieved probably at the maths behind it, but I think that currently they are the number one.
Well, what a positive note to end this episode of Cricket Unfiltered. Paul, great to see you again. And, we'll be live on YouTube this Thursday at 5:30. Are you looking forward to that?
Yeah, I can't wait. Should be good.
All right, well, that's it for this edition of Cricket Unfiltered. Back soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.